As usual, I enjoyed a lot today. It's very nice for me, this rhythm of, for me as a teacher, to sit here quietly and not have to give any instruction. It's very nice. And then have these wonderful interviews where I get to meet people and talk about their practice and kind of all in the context of the sitting, of the day-long sitting and going back and forth between the two of them. So it's a very nice day for me, and I hope it was nice for you to sit this day quietly. So what I want to talk about is perhaps a topic which is not talked very much about in the American Vipassana scene, but it's talked a lot about in the discourses of the Buddha. And that is using our abilities to reflect and to think and to consider things as part of this, of our practice. The mindfulness practice, the non-discursive practice of Vipassana, just being present for things as they are, is sometimes considered to be the cream of Buddhist practice. But if you eat just cream, you get indigestion. But the way many of us, including myself, talk, we put so much emphasis on the mindfulness that often we don't give a very clear sense that there's much more to the Buddhist spiritual life than just being mindfully present. And as I said this morning, there's a tendency, I think, in some American Buddhist circles where it seems almost as if the God of that the present moment has become our God. The present moment is exalted in these wonderful ways, as if it's the greatest end-all and greatest thing there is, just to be present. And being present is, of course, a really wonderful thing. And it can be a great relief for people who spent a lot of time being in the past a lot, or being in the future, or being a fantasy, to really be present for their life as it's unfolding. But as I said also this morning, it's possible to be in the present moment, but our awareness of the present, our engagement, our intention of being part of the present moment is filtered through or is entangled with greed and craving and fear, ill will, hate, and many different factors can come in. A soldier who's fighting with tremendous hate and hostility can be very much in the present moment. You have to be if you're fighting a war. If you're hand-to-hand combat, you better not be thinking about what you had for dinner yesterday. You have to be in the present moment. And I get the sense from talking to some people, some practitioners here in America, that they feel occasionally the only thing they're allowed to do in their mindfulness, in their Buddhist spiritual life, is to be mindfully present for something and accept it, not to manipulate it, just allow it to be there, and just see it for what it is, and that's all they're allowed to do. Now, that's the instructions, of course, in certain contexts, that's what the practice is. But certainly there's more to a spiritual life than just simply being present for what's happening around you and in you all the time. That's the only thing you're allowed to do. So one of the things the Buddha stressed quite a bit, much more than you would ever guess from the way American Vipassana teachers talk, including myself, is that there's tremendous value in living a reflective life and considering and using our powers of our mind to think and reflect and to consider what is wise and what is unwise, what is a skillful course of action in life, in our life, and what is unskillful. And occasionally I get a sense there are people who try to substitute careful reflection, careful consideration of issues in their life They instead of carefully considering and reflecting about their life and issues in their life, they try to just solve everything in their life by only trying to be non-discursively, mindfully present for things as they are. So I wanted to give this talk today to give you some sense that the Buddha taught much more than just simply mindfulness. In the teachings of the Buddha, there's a term for attention, which there's many words that relate to the word attention, awareness, mindfulness, One of the words the Buddha used is manisikara. Manisikara simply means the ability for the mind to pay attention to something, the ability of the mind to turn its attention, turn towards something, and decide I'm going to pay attention to this now. So most of you, your manisikara now is directed towards listening to me. Your attention is directed in this direction. You have attention here. It's a very rudimentary thing that all people have, the ability to pay attention. But the Buddha distinguished between wise attention and unwise attention. And the word he used is yoniso and ayoniso. Yoniso manisikara and ayoniso. A is the negative. And usual translation into English of yoniso is wise. Wise reflection or wise attention. But this word yoniso is very interesting because the word yoni in Pali means womb. And so it's womb-like attention, I like to call it. But most people don't call it that. The way that yoniso is used in Pali, it means more like foundational. That which is most foundational, most kind of original. Has the strongest basis to it, that has a basis, has a foundation to it. So it's the kind of attention that has a basis to it, has a foundation to it. It's quite easy to have an attention which has no basis to it, no foundation to it. And for example, when we live a distracted life, when we're very distracted, part of our attention, our ability to be invested, to engage with our mind into things, is lost and swept up in something which often is baseless, has no real foundation in values that are really central to us, or has no foundation in the depths of our hearts. Many of the kind of petty concerns that many of us will spend much time being concerned about, if you really reflect deeply and carefully about what's most valuable for you and what you most deeply know is important for you, you probably admit that some of the petty concerns that you're caught up in are probably not places you want to be. Probably it doesn't have much foundation to be involved in that. And if you had any kind of spent any bit of time reflecting, you would back off from those kinds of concerns. So there's wise attention and there's unwise attention. There's wise reflection, unwise reflection. And I like the word that's yoni, because it's that which has a foundation. Maybe we can understand it to be there's a kind of attention, a kind of reflection, which is the womb for our spiritual life, that gives birth to a kind of depth of connectedness to ourselves and depth of freedom I think is the point of spiritual life. And there's a kind of attention, a kind of reflection, which is not a womb, isn't a compost, or isn't the compost pile for clarifying and purifying our life. So it's not simply a matter of just paying attention, knowing what's going on in the present moment, but it can be very valuable, once you know what's going on in the present moment, to evaluate that and decide, is this really valuable for me to pursue, to let my attention be preoccupied and concerned with these kinds of thoughts, these kinds of concerns? Or should I pull away from that and be concerned about something else? Now, to think about, to give very kind of maybe you know, kind of maybe obvious example is whatever you spend the most amount of time doing, that tends to shape your intentions, your disposition, shapes who you are to some degree. So if you're, if all you ever think about is money, and you're constantly thinking about how you make more money and how you can save your money, and constantly concerned about the stock market, and ups and downs of the stock market, and that constant preoccupation to have your mind always, you might be very attentive and know, oh, I'm thinking about money all the time. You might know that. But still, the fact is, you remain thinking about money all the time, always concerned about that. That constant preoccupation is shaping your disposition, shaping the habits of your mind, shaping, in a sense, your character and who you are. And we see the results of that. It was very touching for me when I gave a talk last Monday. I think some of you were there on contentment, and the value of contentment in a spiritual life. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I was in business for many years, there's no value in contentment in the business world, according to him, in the corporate world he's in. Especially, you know, in the high-tech world here in Silicon Valley, where you're supposed to be working so hard. I read the next day or two an account of the kind of people that Bill Gates likes to gather around him. Bill Gates is a very competitive man, and likes to gather around him people who are very competitive, and people who are really out to kind of make Microsoft a great success. Now, people who are basically content with themselves and with their hearts and their life are not going to be driven to be competitive and to kind of overcome and conquer their competition. And there's a certain level of anxiety or drivenness or lack of contentment, discontent, which really fuels for some in certain areas of business a great success in the business. But I don't know if that really fuels success for our inner life. Some of that is ungrounded. It's activity which doesn't have a real foundation. If our drivenness to succeed in, for example, in anything, is based on a sense of insecurity or a sense of discontent or a sense of void or emptiness in our life, then to some degree, the activities that arise out of that or a reaction to that are activities and reflections and activities that don't have a real foundation in our gut, in our heart. You know, if you spend a lot of time, anything we obsess about. So if we endlessly reading, if you endlessly read horror books or go to horror movies, I think with time it tends to kind of shape the mind a little bit in how we see things. If we endlessly listen to politicians, you know, and just that's all we tend to do. I think the politicians are trying to shape our mind, shape our emotional connection to our reality around us, to kind of to get our attention, to get our vote. So we know there are politicians who speak a lot about fear, who speak to our fear, and so they try to tell us how terrible things are, how high the crime rate is, and they use certain statistics or certain examples of certain dramatic crimes to speak to our fears. And the result of constantly having our attention focused on object of fear like this affects our dispositions and the way we see the world. I think it's quite dramatic, the examples that the people who reported how on one hand, the amount of reporting of crime that our newspapers have provided has gone up over the last 20, 30 years. And more and more the big kind of sensationalistic crimes end up on the front page, and there's more and more reporting of crimes, and the local television news, you know, focuses a lot on local crimes. This is all well known, I think, because it kind of gets people to watch their programs more. But actually, in the last 9 years or something, the crime rate has dropped. So while the crime rate is dropping, the reporting of crime has gone up. And then people's gut feeling, idea of is that their idea is, oh, the crime is going up and up and up. That's the kind of what people think is happening. But statistically, overall crime is going down. I think this is phenomenal. And I think it's partly an example of how the thing we obsess about, things we fill our attention with over and over again without any careful reflection of what we're reading, tends to shape the way we see ourselves and shape we see the world. If we're consumed with greed, and we're constantly feeding that greed, we'll become more greedy. What we think regularly. So Buddhists don't say what you eat is what you become. They say what you think is what you become. And if you spend a lot of time thinking a particular thing, that tends to shape our disposition and habits over time. So the Buddha then taught that it's valuable to see the directions where our attention is directed, to look at the objects, the concerns that our attention is takes up. And to take some responsibility for that. Not just simply to be aware of it, but sometimes to stop thinking those things. Stop being involved in those things, those activities. If you find that spending a lot of time with certain friends makes you more angry, makes you more hostile. I mean, there are some people around who love being angry a lot. They kind of get off on it, and they spend a lot of time complaining about other people, criticizing other people, and there can be a lot of camaraderie that arises out of shared complaining. And if people feel a little bit alienated and want to have some feeling of human contact, you get a lot of energetic human contact by spending a lot of time complaining, mutually complaining, and bitching, right, about this and that. But the result of it is it tends to create a habit of complaining, of hostility, and you might find yourself, after being involved in certain activities, you're more likely to get ticked off or get angry or be afraid or be a certain way. So to really assess, you know, is it really valuable? Is it really having a good influence on us to be have these subjects of attention over and over again? Some people I know have chosen not to read newspapers so much because the particular way that they're disposed to react or respond to the newspapers is they get so discouraged. And they didn't find it's not so useful to go around being so discouraged all the time. And so they've chosen not to read newspapers. So I wanted to read to you an example from the discourses where the Buddha talks about wise reflection or wise attention and how you can actually, it's sometimes very wise to turn your attention away from something or turn your attention towards something else. So the Buddha said, "Before my enlightenment, while I was still an unenlightened person, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual craving, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And then I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty." So apparently the Buddha, before he was enlightened, had thoughts of cruelty, and had thoughts of ill will, and had thoughts of sensual craving. Who doesn't? But he wanted to divide up his thoughts between the kind, those which had ill will and cruelty and sensual craving, and those that didn't. So then, as I considered thus, a thought of sensual craving arose in me. And I understood thus, this thought of sensual craving has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction. It leads to other people's affliction, to the affliction of everyone. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana, from freedom. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulty, it leads away from nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual craving arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So here what he's doing, he's recognizing clearly that sensual craving has risen in him. And then he's reflecting on it, he's considering it in this formulaic way. What value does this have for me? What are the consequences for me for having this, being engaged and involved with this kind of activity? And what he found was that the consequences of being preoccupied and consumed by sensual craving is that it tended to cause him suffering. He calls it affliction here. It didn't lead to his own good. It obstructed his ability to be wise. It obstructed his ability to become free. And what's interesting here is that he's not judging it negatively. He's not saying this is bad or I'm evil or this is a terrible thing to have. But it's very pragmatic. He's saying he's recognizing the consequences of having these kinds of thoughts. And he's saying, you know, realizing those are the consequences, I don't think that's so interesting for me to pursue that. And then he describes it here. He says, it subsided in me. I think it's almost natural for most of us when we see that something is harming us, that we tend to kind of pull away a little bit. We relax our hold on it. We don't fuel it as much. And sensual craving is interesting because many of us in the West have this tremendous passion for sensual desires and everything. What's wrong with that, we say? And there's nothing maybe inherently wrong, but the way that some of us are involved in it, pursuing our sensual craving, if you're really honest, you'll see that it obstructs your heart, or it keeps you from being really sensitive to the world around you, or to yourself, or actually causes a lot of distress. And if you see that that's consequences, then maybe you relax it. I've known people who've told me that they've, when they really became aware of the consequences of being angry, the consequences to themselves, they say, I don't want to bother. Why bother being so angry? You know, I want to hurt that person so badly, but this person's my enemy, and the person's done me a lot of harm. But now I'm doing this person a great favor. The person really wants to hurt me, and I'm just helping the person out by being so consumed with anger, because anger is so painful for the person who's being angry. So it isn't so easy, of course, to let go of anger that easily as this. But there are some people who find that just recognizing the consequences to themselves of holding anger, that the anger subsides. They're not so interested in holding it anymore. So the Buddha did the same reflection with cruelty. He says, a thought of cruelty arose in me. Isn't that great? That the Buddha himself, before he was enlightened, had a thought of cruelty? I think it's great. It's kind of a relief. He's just like us. And then he did the same thing. He considered it. He didn't only just see it in the way we do see it in mindfulness. Just see it for what it is. See it that's there. Note it. Feel it in the body and all these things. It's very valuable to do those things. It certainly has its place to do those things. But there's also a place to reflect and to consider. What are the consequences of being involved in this kind of activity? With these kinds of thought? Should I continue kind of thinking thoughts of cruelty? Or if I do that, what are the consequences to me? And then he realized that the consequences are it causes him increased suffering, and it clouds his wisdom, and it prevents him from becoming free. And then he has a very interesting statement, which many people say in different ways, but he said, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of that person's mind. So this is the principle, that whatever what you think is what you become. If you constantly think and constantly reflect and constantly concerned about a certain thing, then you slowly become that kind of, that becomes the inclination of your mind, the habit of your mind, your disposition. So if you're constantly concerned about money, that's all you're thinking about, then that's going to shape your disposition. So you kind of the mind gets into kind of a rut, or kind of gets in. You're more likely in the future to be anxious about money, or if you're constantly thinking about, what are some of the things? You fill in the blanks, please. So we need to be careful with our minds. We can be careful with where our attention goes, and take some responsibility for it. And again, it's significant that Buddha did not blame himself or criticize himself for having cruelty. There wasn't any sense of guilt or shame in having it. I think it's just matter-of-factly tells us, I had thoughts of cruelty. There was no one, he's not hiding it from us. Buddhist practice is not the practice of judging ourselves negatively, but rather it's a practice of great compassion, of seeing ourselves as we actually are, and then in a very straightforward way, seeing what we can do to do better. Then he has a very interesting statement here. As I was considering thus, abiding thus, meditating, a thought of renunciation arose in me. Now, renunciation belongs to the other side, right? The good side, so-called, right? You divide it into two classes. And so there was the side of cruelty and sensual craving and all that, and then there was renunciation. And so in a sense, maybe this is the more desirable direction and the more wholesome thing. So he considered, this arose, thought of renunciation arose for him, letting go. And he thought, this does not lead to my suffering. It doesn't cause suffering for other people. It supports and aids wisdom. It does not cause difficulties, and it leads to nirvana, to nibbana, to freedom. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. So basically, it's a wholesome thing. He doesn't. He can even obsess about this kind of thought. And the thought itself, he's nothing to be afraid of it. It's not going to cause any difficulties to be afraid of. But then he says, but with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So he's saying, even if you have a really great thought about something, some really wonderful, noble thought, if you obsess about it, it maybe disposes you in a good direction, but it'll tire you out, and it tires out the body. Isn't that great? I think it's great. So don't even spend a lot of time thinking about noble things. It's fine to do that. But it'll keep you from being concentrated. It'll keep you from really being settled and seeing really deeply in the way you're supposed to when you get concentrated. So there is a time for realizing. So one of the ways to consider, to reflect about our experience, is the consequences, likely consequences of what's going on. And if our thoughts are constantly preoccupied in ways where the consequences are unhealthy for us, cause difficulty for us, dispose us to react in ways we don't want to react in the future, then maybe we should start pulling ourselves away from that kind of concern, that kind of activity. And if those kinds of thoughts and concerns support, are the womb or the support or the aid to developing wisdom and compassion and caring and connectedness to others, maybe we can support those kinds of thoughts and those kinds of preoccupation in those thoughts. If you go and rent a video and you have a choice between renting, I don't see videos very much. What's two good examples? You know, if
Terminator and Sound of Music.
Yeah. Choose something else. But you know, you get the idea, right? The Buddha put a lot of actually emphasis on the importance of wise reflection, wise consideration. And what I'm trying to say today is that suggest that you consider this as part of your spiritual life, is that you also reflect and consider. And how do you reflect and how do you consider? So it's more than just knowing the consequences of what you're thinking, what your mind is focused on, and deciding you can turn away and focus on other things. But it's also you can actually consider things in a wise way, and you consider things in unwise ways. The Buddha said that it's unwise to consider your life, consider your issues of your life, from the point of view of a self, of your self-identity. If you have an identity of this is who I am, it's actually unwise to consider your difficulties and your issues in your life from that point of view. And that's a real challenge for many of us who really think that our self-image or self-identity is really centrally important to who we are and what's going on. And then people often make the protest and say, well, you know, you need to have a strong sense of self in order to let go of it or something. And you need to have a strong image for various reasons or strong self-identity. What the Buddha said was that the idea of a self is a certain framework of how to understand our life. And it might not be the most useful framework to understand our life through. The Buddha then offered a different framework. He said, you should consider your life this way. He used this framework for understanding your life. And he suggested the framework of the Four Noble Truths. You can address your problems and your difficulties and understand them from the point of the Four Noble Truths, without having to posit a self-identity, without creating a self-identity at all. And I'm saying this very simplistically now, but if you reflect on it, think about it, or practice with it, you'll see that it's actually very profound. That most of the difficulties in our lives can be understood from the framework of the Four Noble Truths. If you try to understand it from the framework of a self, of a self-image, self-identity, the danger of that is that you might have some resolution, some understanding that's helpful, but you're building your understanding on quicksand. You're building your understanding on something which is not really very reliable. Because our self-image, our self-identity, is never... It might have some accuracy to it, but it's never the true story of who we are. You cannot hold a self-image, an idea of who you are that's accurate, because it's always going to be partial. And if it's always partial, then it's always unreliable to really be reliable to who you really are. But the Four Noble Truths, I think are really reliable framework for understanding our difficulties in our life, to understand, to actually see the suffering for what it is, as opposed to seeing it through the filter of our self-image. To really see our suffering, the cause of our suffering, the cause of our suffering, rather than seeing it through the various interpretations and blames and self and ideas of self that are tied into it. It's very powerful to have a different framework to reflect on our life. All of us have a framework. All of us have a category in which we understand our life. And the Buddha is suggesting that it might be interesting for you to step outside of your normal categories in which you reflect on your life and reflect on it from a different set of categories. One of the categories that Buddhists like to offer you is the category of impermanence. Another category is the category of dependent arising, that nothing arises independent of everything, independent of other things, that things arise independent of other things. And if you begin looking and reflecting on your life and on the causes and conditions of your life from the point of view of how they arise in dependence of other things, there's a possibility of a lot much more freedom than if you see things through the category that things are fixed and permanent. This is the way things are always going to be. When you feel in the midst of some terrible depression, and the kind of gut emotional reaction of many of us is kind of, you might intellectually know better, it's like, oh, this is forever, this is permanent, or some great difficulty you have in your life. But to see that it's dependently arisen, that it arises because of certain conditions and it'll pass when certain conditions pass, is very helpful. So we don't get locked in and get kind of frozen in some fixed idea of how things have to be. To see the impermanence of things, to see the flux of things, to see how things arise and pass. The Buddha said that some of the greatest wisdom that can be developed arises when we see the beginning of things, when they first arise. And many people don't see the arising of something when they first arise, but don't really notice something until it's been around for a while. And part of the function of mindfulness is to develop enough strength of attention to notice when things first arise. For example, the opportunity when things first arise is the opportunity to see what has triggered it. So for example, if you get angry, it's all too easy to be stuck in the middle of your anger and your resentment and be swept up in it, but not have noticed what happened just when the anger began. And if you're really there to see the angers arise, you might notice that what happened was you were afraid. And it's a whole different game if you see the fear that's connected to your anger as opposed to seeing the anger itself. So to start seeing our life through the framework of how things are conditioned, how things arise from each other, how things one thing leads to another, is a lot wiser than seeing things as being fixed. So the Buddha suggested that it's very valuable to change the framework, the categories through which you see your life. So he offered the framework of the Four Noble Truths. He offered the framework of impermanence. He offered the framework of dependent arising, how things arise in dependence of other things. Now, some people will protest and say, well, this is exhausting, you know, just more intellectual activity. And I just want to do a non-discursive mindfulness practice where I don't have to think so much. Now, this is good because a lot of Westerners think too much anyway. We're very intellectual often, so it's very great relief to find a spiritual practice which isn't so discursive. But in offering different frameworks to understand our life, the Buddha is... We can't not have a framework. Living our normal life, we can't not have a framework in order to understand our life. So we're already doing that kind of work. So it's very interesting to change that for a little bit, maybe for a few days or a few hours, and get a different perspective and see if the new perspective changes how you understand the old framework. The old saying that they apparently exists in England, they say, you can't really understand England until you leave England. If you're in the middle of certain, if you're always in the middle of your life, the same kind of situation over and over again, you don't get some fresh air, don't step outside of it for a while, you can't really know yourself in that situation. You don't really know England unless you leave England and be able to see it from a distance. You don't know America unless you've been abroad a little bit and go back and see it from whole different eyes. You don't really know who you are until... some of you might not even know who you are until you go on vacation. You know, that's what you need more than anything else. So we need human beings, it's very valuable, we need some different framework, different perspective to understand our life from sometimes. So the Buddha offered these things, and it's useful to do that. Part of the reflection and consideration is to know when it's useful not to bring a framework of understanding, but rather to do the silent, non-discursive mindfulness that slowly with time, as it gets stronger and as the stability and concentration gets stronger. The mindfulness gets stronger and we can hold this non-discursive awareness to the present moment and see things directly as they are without the interpretations, without the assigning of meanings to it, without the assigning of identifications to it, without our judgments to it, just see it for what it is. All the interpretations, all the assigning of meaning, all the words connected to it, all the attachments and all all those things start falling away. As we get more concentrated, the more concentrated we are, the harder it is for us to stay involved in our intellectual assigning of meaning and values and future thinking and past thinking and apprehensions and hopefulness about what's happening. And it's such a great relief to have an experience of being present where we're not interpreting anything. We're just present for the way things are. And the deepest freedoms, the deepest freedom of the heart, the deepest freedom of the mind that's possible happens when we're no longer in any kind of way interpreting our experience, assigning meaning to it. And when we don't see it anymore through any kind of framework, any categories. Now, because that's the deepest freedom that the Buddhist tradition offers, some people will focus so much on that non-discursive clear seeing that they won't take care of other areas of their life. And part of there are times in our life when it's appropriate to reflect and consider, and maybe to hold our life from different categories. We don't abandon all categories and all careful thinking in favor only non-discursively looking at things. There are times, and so in my own life, there's times in my life where I do the non-discursive mindfulness practice. And there are times in my life where I'll consider and reflect about what's going on in my life, what's going on in my thoughts, what I'm preoccupied, what I'm concerned about. There are times when I turn my attention away from certain kinds of preoccupations because I feel it's not very healthy or useful to do that. It causes me causes me suffering to be preoccupied and concerned with those things. So that was my thoughts for today. I wanted to. I don't know if it was useful for you to for me to give this talk, but I wanted to give you some. For those of you who might not have realized it, to give you some sense of that in the teachings of the Buddha, he put a lot of value on wise reflection and wise attention. And you might consider now a little bit what in your own life, what wise attention might be. What it's wise to pay attention to in your life, and what it's wise to consider, what kind of considerations, what kind of reflections are really wise and helpful for you, and what kind of considerations and reflections are not wise, are not helpful for you. Did you have a question? So maybe it's time I give a talk on the Four Noble Truths soon again. The first noble truth is that there's suffering. So the first noble truth is a call for us to be really honest about the suffering that is in our life, to really see it for what it is. And it's not so easy to do that, because many of us want to turn away from it, want to avoid it, want to pretty up life and not see what's really going on. So the first noble truth is that there's suffering does occur in life. The second noble truth is that there's a cause for the suffering. And the cause of our suffering is our drivenness, the way we're driven, our clinging, our craving, our thirst. The suffering which Buddhism is trying to address is optional. And it's optional because it arises based on how we choose to relate to the world. And if we choose to relate to it out of craving or being driven, or being hostile to the world, or any kind of attachment, or any kind of thirst, or clinging, we're setting ourselves up to suffer. The third noble truth is that it's possible to live a life without this optional suffering. It's possible to end our craving and our drivenness and be at peace. And the fourth noble truth is a truth that basically says it's not so easy to do this. and so the Buddha then laid out what's called the Eightfold Path, which is eight different aspects or different practices, eight different supports for the practice of releasing ourselves from this optional craving or drivenness that causes us our suffering. And different people find different steps of the Eightfold Path most helpful for them. There are some people who primarily get tremendous help from cleaning up their ethical life. And so there's three different steps of the Eightfold Path has to do with basically ethical steps: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Then there's two steps have to do with wise reflection. Spending some time reflecting. Some people don't reflect enough about their life and don't have a clue what their intentions, their motivations, and their thoughts. And so the two of them have to do with using your ability to reflect and consider. Particularly reflecting on your intentions. One of the very, very important things that Buddhists are encouraged to reflect on and consider and be mindful of is their intentions. And think about their intentions, the consequences of their intentions, and really... And then the last three of the Eightfold Paths have to do with practice itself. Mindfulness, concentration, and then energy or engagement, being engaged energetically, not holding back, not hesitating in the practice, but really engaging oneself in mindfulness. So those are the Four Noble Truths. And what's the beauty of it is that if you can see, all of us have some difficulty in our life. And if we see it in its simplicity of what actually it is, so for example, if I am really attached to coffee ice cream, and they run out, they don't have coffee ice cream in the store when I go to buy it, I can suffer. But if I see that the cause of suffering is my attachment to coffee ice cream, I can let go of that. But if my suffering gets tied into my idea of self, I am a kind of person who depends on coffee ice cream, and it's an affront to my individuality that Safeway has run out of coffee ice cream, and they've gone to, you know, I can make this whole story about self that's tied up to this thing. It was actually very, very simple. And so this is often the case when we start tying in notions of self with our suffering, and this is what it means about me and myself, we're actually complicating something which could be a lot simpler, much more simpler than we realize. And so the Four Noble Truths is pointing to the simplicity of our suffering. Yes.
In reflecting on things that may be coming up for us, like some of the five hindrances, something that's very strong, something that's a very deep pattern in our lives, the reflection may not be adequate to steer our attention from just going deeper and deeper into thoughts about that, or the ill will, let's say the anger maybe building. And at those kinds of times, when is it appropriate and when may it not be appropriate to use anecdotes, things that would compete?